Elon Musk has the Tesla Car Corporation, so he took one of his cars and he used it as a payload because it was the first test of that vehicle. And it worked out pretty good. They had cameras on board, and you could see the car, you know, leaving Earth and going into a solar orbit. And the two boosters, the ones on the port side and starboard side of this main core, came back and landed right back at Cape Canaveral. It was daytime. It was very impressive. The core, they also wanted to save. They were hoping that was going to land on a booster out in the ocean. And, it came down. They ran out of fuel for the hydraulics, and it crashed right next to the drone ship. But the payload was successful. It got his car into orbit, and his Falcon Heavy worked out. So since then, he's put the Falcon Heavy into his manifest. You know, he's been launching rocket after rocket, either privately or for NASA. And in April, he launched another Falcon Heavy, a couple of months ago. And he launched it for a satellite for Saudi Arabia. And that was a successful launch. Again, the two boosters successfully came back to Cape Canaveral and landed in Landing Zone 1, he calls it. Used to be a Launch Complex 13, but he rebuilt it. They're landing zones now. And the two boosters came down, successfully landed. And the third booster successfully landed on the drone ship. So, everybody was at SpaceX was very happy. They saved all three cores this time. The only problem is, it lands vertically and sits on this drone ship. Now, the drone ship is as big as a football field. And it usually takes 24 hours or so before they tow this drone ship all the way back to Cape Canaveral. The problem is when that landed, soon after that, they had rough waves as it was, but the waves increased to about 20 feet or so. And shortly after landing, before they could really secure the vehicle to the drone ship, they use this robotic contraption that comes out. This big door that opens up on the drone ship, and this thing comes riding out and goes underneath the core and has these big arms that reach up and grab hold of it, and it stabilizes the ship. They didn't get a chance to do that, and because of the high waves, the thing tipped over and they kind of lost the boost. I think they saved some of the rockets. This third time, they think that it might make it. The weather's supposed to be good. The difference is it's a night launch. Not that it matters because, it's all done autonomously. The computers on board the Falcon 9, with all the three boosters, the three Falcon 9s, run independent of one another. The idea of bringing two boosters back to Florida was kind of unnerving for the military, that, 45th Wing, that they want to make sure everything's safe along the coast. When they first heard about this, they we can't do it because, we have radar that we send out to these boosters as they're going up and as they're coming back. We have to see exactly where they are, and if they're going a little off course, you push the abort button and the booster will explode. To avoid all that, SpaceX has put in super duper, GPS type system inside each booster. So when they're coming back, the boosters know exactly where they're located. So, when they're coming back to Florida, if they're a little off, and they see that there's something wrong, they'll ignite, they'll blow themselves up. They did have problems with one about a year ago. It was coming back, and it was starting to lose control. It was supposed to be coming back to Florida. And it sort of, instead of blowing itself up, though, it just decided to, they have a program to to stop going toward the shore and bring it straight down, and it landed in the ocean, you know, like 10 miles out in the ocean. So that's, you know, that's plan A. Plan B, if it was, you know, really heading toward the coast, it would ignite it. And that would be okay. So that's the story. They have 24 satellites going up. They're launching satellites for NOAA, you know, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. They're launching satellites for NASA. That's one reason that you'll be able to see this on the NASA webcast. For instance, the last heavy that went up in April, when they launched that Arab satellite, they didn't have it on the NASA's TV because there was no NASA satellites involved. So, but you know, even if there's like 10 cents worth of something on that vehicle that's going up, one of the satellites, then NASA will put it on. And if you don't want to watch that, you know, it's really the same transmissions, but I find it's a lot better to watch the SpaceX version on their webcast. They do a pretty good job. Sometimes it's a little different. Sometimes NASA cuts part of the scene off early, but with the SpaceX webcast, they run it all the way through. In the beginning, NASA, you know, if they launched the payload into space, might have been a cargo going to a space station, they wouldn't follow the booster all the way down. So, you know, what happened? But if you have the SpaceX webcast programmed into your computer, you're better off looking at that, because they definitely will show the boosters, you know, going either back to Cape Canaveral or to the drone ship. Anyway, this will be tomorrow night, 11:30, and the window is all the way to 3:30. And if it doesn't go off, then, you know, they'll announce the next day that it will go off. So looking forward to seeing how they do. They have tremendous capability of, you know, with this particular rocket going up. If they wanted to, they could put 150,000 pounds into low Earth orbit, or, you know, maybe almost 60,000 pounds into geosynchronous orbit. So they've improved over the years. They've had different versions of the Falcon 9 that they've come a long way. They increase the thrust on each engine. It's got 9 engines. They'll make the booster longer, they'll be able to carry more fuel, and they're getting better all the time. And if anybody knows about the cost of these things when they go up, for instance, when an Atlas goes up, an Atlas V from the United Launch Alliance, you know, they pretty much had a monopoly on all of NASA's spacecraft for years and decades. Well, they started in early 2000s with the United Launch Alliance. But it would cost, you know, $150 million or more dollars, you know, to launch something. With SpaceX, they've got it down to $62 million for a Falcon 9, just a typical launch by SpaceX. And this big one that goes up, it's around $110 million for a Falcon 9 Heavy. And the good news is the boosters are all reusable, so they bring them back, they refurbish everything the best they can. So essentially, their goal is to just be able to refuel these things and send them up again. The second stage is going to release all these different satellites to different locations. It's 24 different satellites, so like I said before, for NOAA or for NASA, and they're going to try something a little different. That second stage, we'll be able to, they're going to relight that thing to a different orbit, different satellites going to different orbits, they'll relight thing 4 different times, and that will be the first for SpaceX. Anyway, this this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Any questions or comments?
AC2LR, I have an Apollo 11 question, if I may.
AC2LR, go ahead.
As I'm watching, they're saying the hatch is closed and the astronauts are inside and they're now pumping in an atmosphere of 60% oxygen and 40% nitrogen. And that seems like a lot of oxygen. And then the guy said, but in their spacesuits, they're breathing 100% oxygen. Do you know why they would, why not just make it natural 20% oxygen like our atmosphere has?
Okay, well, after the Apollo fire, and that was, what, January 27th of 1967, when we lost Ed White, Chaffee, and Gus Grissom, and that fire, that had 100% oxygen, and they said, well, this is what we're going to do, we're going to run 100% oxygen in our spacecraft, and we won't have any problem, and, you know, we'll just leave it like this. That we did it like that for Gemini, and we did it for Mercury, everything was fine. But, you know, as you know, it, you know, things went very bad. So the future spacecrafts were designed with more nitrogen and a lot less oxygen. They didn't want that, you know, the ignition system to happen. When it came to this, when it comes to the spaces themselves, yeah, they run pure oxygen. So normally, what do we, if it's 0.1% oxygen, you know, in your room right now, and in the space station, that's what they have now too, and also the shuttle, they've duplicated the Earth's atmosphere. It was a little different for Apollo, but now standard pressure is. The same as what we have here, and Apollo did have a lot of nitrogen. So this way, eliminate the fire possibility. So whatever oxygen you're breathing at 20%, that's enough to keep you going. If you reduce that pressure from 14.7 pounds, which is again what's in our room, your ambient pressure, let me drop it. And you bring it down to 5 pounds, eventually down to 4 pounds. You know, in the space, it's around 4 pounds of pressure. Very, very little pressure. If you had nitrogen and oxygen in, you know, you wouldn't, you know, at that same ratio, you wouldn't have enough oxygen, you know, for your system to work. Your muscles would work out too good. I don't think your brain would either. So to compensate for that, they run pure oxygen. But yet now they can run at a low pressure. You really want a low pressure in your spacesuit because if you, you know, when you fill up your spacesuit, if you put in 14.7 pounds of pressure, you know, you'd be like the Michelin Man. You wouldn't be able to bend your arms. You wouldn't be able to bend your legs. But with lower pressure, of course, you can. Still not easy. You know, they have a hard time, you know, moving around in there. But over time, they've really improved on things. I think that's pretty much what they were getting at on that TV show, that, you know, it's showing the difference between the spacecraft and the, you know, are they talking about, by the way, are they talking about the LEM or are they talking about the Apollo spacecraft itself, the command module? Back to you, Kay.
It looked like it's 2 hours before launch and the astronauts had just gone up a little trellis elevator and gone inside and somebody checked their suits and then he left and they shut the door behind him. And then, so wherever they were in the cockpit, I don't know what you call it, they said, we are now filling that in with, you know, 60% oxygen, 40% nitrogen, but the suits will be filled with oxygen. But thanks for the explanation. I didn't even think about the low pressure. So, AC2LR.
Okay, very good. And if you watch a lot of these documentaries so that NASA has on, or interviews with the astronauts, it's really cool. The other day they had the, let's see, there's still two women on board. There's and they had an interview with both of them. There's six people up there right now, but their interview was with Christina Kokas. Now she's going to be up there for almost a year. She was thinking she's going to be 5-6 months, and they, oh no, let's make it a year. So she'll be up there a while, and they talk about the pressure. Sometimes, you know, somebody will ask a question, and that might come up. But they are living in 14.7 pounds of pressure, just like we are here, and the same percentages with the oxygen. Was it 70% or something? And then, you know, for nitrogen, some 21% or something for our oxygen. The only difference is they don't have all the mixed gases. They don't have the argon, and you know, I think we have a certain percentage of other gases that, of course, they don't have on the space station. And that's the deal. Any comments or questions? And I'm sure I should ask Roy if I got my percentages right, but I think I do. This is WS2F.
Thank you. AC2LR.
It sounds like a good documentary. Yeah, no, they've been advertising it for weeks now, I guess, on CNN. So, yeah, okay. Now, I just want to move to, you know, from Earth orbit to what's going on Mars. You have, naturally Curiosity still riding around on that planet. The other two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, are no longer operative. So we do have one rover left, and that's Curiosity. And it's nuclear powered. It's been running around since 2012, but you have a new vehicle going up in the end of 2020, I think around September of 2020, and that's going to be the 2020 roll, but they haven't given it a name yet, and it will be landing early 2021, and it's going to have a lot of different experiments on board, just like Curiosity does, but these more updated. And one particular one I like, talking about oxygen, is something called the MOXIE unit that they're putting on the 2020 rover. And MOXIE stands for Mars Oxygen In-Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. Well, a MOXIE unit is, it's a small unit, you know, maybe 10 pounds or so, 10, 20 pounds. And it's you know, sitting inside the body of the 2020 rover. And the idea of this thing is it's going to take the atmosphere from Mars. It's going to take the CO2. It's, you know, Mars has mostly carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's going to essentially inhale the carbon dioxide and then create oxygen. And once they can get a container of oxygen, and they know they can do this, if it works out okay, you might eventually have independent flights just to go to Mars to create oxygen. This way you'll have oxygen waiting for astronauts when they land in the future, or you'll have oxygen available for fuel, for, you know, to assist the fuel for whatever they need, or maybe you're going to use it for fuel cells. Well, the way the MOXIE system works is it's essentially a reverse fuel cell. A fuel cell, normally you would take, let's say, hydrogen or an oxygen, that's gas, and you would pass it through a catalyst. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Repeater, timeout. Okay, so the system is a reverse fuel cell. So what they're going to do is they're going to take the carbon dioxide and they're going to pull it through a little, like, quarter-inch diameter line. And, you know, I could see they had a picture of it on the NASA website. And they're going to pull the carbon dioxide in through this quarter-inch diameter tube. It's going to go inside, and it's going to be heated to it's going to be like 1,500 degrees. If you can convert that, it's like 800 degrees Celsius, but, you know, like 1,500 degrees. It's going to get hot. They're going to heat this carbon dioxide, and then they're going to apply a positive and a negative. You know, they have an anode and a cathode line, and they look pretty thick. Each cathode line going down into this box is, looks like around a quarter inch thick, so it's a heavy-duty anode. Not sure how much amperage you're going to be pouring into this, or even what the voltage is going to be. But that will separate the carbon gases from the oxygen. The oxygen is going to come up through another, like an eighth inch tube, smaller diameter, and that will be stored. And then the waste gas left over is going to come up another. Eighth inch diameter tube, and that'll be exhausted into the atmosphere. So it's going to be NASA's first attempt to actually create a substance, a valuable substance that we're going to need on another planet if Moxie works. I'm going to keep my eye on whether or not Moxie works a couple of years from now after this thing lands. Let me drop it. And they've got a couple of new different experimental things or practical things that they're going to use. They have something called the Terrain Relative Navigation System. And essentially, it's a camera that's mounted on the bottom of Curiosity. If you remember, at the bottom of the 2020 lander, when Curiosity came down through the atmosphere on EDO, entry, descent, and landing. You know, it separated from the cruise vehicle, and it came through the atmosphere. Had a heat shield. The heat shield was protecting it. Eventually, the parachutes popped out. The heat shield separated from the whole contraption, and you have Curiosity folded up inside this aeroshell, and it's coming down on parachutes. And as it got like a mile or so off the ground, the parachute top section just disconnected, and it just dropped the, looks like, they call it a sky crane. You know, it dropped this whole setup, and on the bottom of the sky crane is with Curiosity. And the sky crane had a half a dozen rockets pointing out around a 45-degree angle. And this way, you won't fry the vehicle below you. And then they had these cables that lowered the vehicle, Curiosity, from the sky crane until it was extended all the way. And then as this whole setup was coming closer to the surface, right after the wheels touched down, they had these pyrotechnic cutters that cut the cables, and the sky crane flew away. This is WS2M. Well, they're going to have the same setup on the 2020 rover. But the only difference with this this terrain relative navigation system is they're going to have these cameras mounted on the bottom. They had cameras on Curiosity, but these cameras are going to be tied into the rocket system. And as it's coming down, it might see a big boulder, or it might see a big hole, or it might see a cliff. The cameras will send that information to the computer. The computer's going to figure this out, what it is, and if it's dangerous, it's going to move the whole setup one way or the other, and it's going to look for a flat area to land the 2020 rover. Of course, that's going to come in handy when we start sending other vehicles, including people, to Mars. You know, you don't want to come down and hit the side of a cliff or something. Let me drop it. So I thought that was pretty good. And there's other little experiments that are going to be on 2020 as well. They want to know what's the best material, for instance, that we could use for spacesuits on Mars. and they have a good idea of this, that, and the other thing. Well, let's send five different pieces of different types of fabrics or whatever it might be, and they're going to have it on, you know, the outside of the 2020 rover, and they'll be able to image it with a camera up close and do tests on these five pieces of material, and they want to see how it holds up over time on the planet, you know, see what kind of life it has, you know, with all the CO2 and low pressure and the winds, not that they're very strong winds, you know, they're powerful, they might be, you know, 100 mile an hour winds, but if you stood there, you wouldn't blow over because the pressure is so low, it's like less than one-tenth of the amount of pressure we have here on Earth. So, that's what they're going to be sending up to Mars. Also has a radar imager. I think it's located in the bottom and the back of this vehicle. The radar imager is going to be transmitting RF into the surface. They say it's a RF system. They're going to go from 150 megahertz all the way up to 1200. So I'm not sure what the sweet spot is, why they, you know, it's a vague number. But anyway, on Curiosity, the Russians contributed a system. It was called a DAN unit, the Dynamic Albedo Neutron System. And it wasn't RF, they were detecting neutrons and stuff going into the surface, and they were able to go down about 2 feet to see if there's any water or ice underneath the surface as the rover drove along. This one's a lot better. This one is going to be able to look down 33 feet into the ground, so from 2 feet down to 33 feet with this imaging system using RF. So I thought that was pretty neat, especially as a ham. Any comments or questions? This is WS2X.
WB2BXL.
WB2BXL, go ahead. Was it W2 or WB2?
It's WB2BXO, Frank, currently located in Northeast Philadelphia. How are you? There was a report, I think it was yesterday, that NASA has apparently published yet another paper indicating that the rover had detected more elevated methane levels, which of course is a biomarker, that I remember hearing that, and I also saw that included in an astronomy class I took online that was recorded about 5 years ago. So that's not new. What's new, if you've seen that? What's new about the latest NASA report on that? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, they have the ability to sniff out methane, and it's the amount of methane that they are sniffing out. It's way a lot more. I think it's 28 parts per billion. When they thought they had a lot, when they first landed in 2012, soon after that, they detected, I think it was less than half of that. So they figured out that the only way you can get this is most likely way of getting this is some kind of biological life that might be on the ground creating it. So you know they're going to look into this. They're definitely going to examine this a lot more with the next rover and anything else that goes up. You know, after that, there's something called the Trace satellite that's in orbit around Mars. And that was sent up by the European Space Agency, and that thing was really designed to look for methane. We have one as well called MAVEN, but TRACE was really the one that had found slight traces of methane at one time, but not that much right now. And right now, that's strange because Curiosity is finding a lot of methane. So NASA decided to, they always have this pre-planned system of, oh, we're going to go here, we're going to go there, we're going to look at this rock or drill into this rock. And, you know, they're slowing that down and they're taking that time. They're doing more measurements, and so far everything coming back. Let me drop it. Is what you said. They have, you know, showing methane. So why is the number so high? And they do have methane in the vehicle itself, contained in the vehicle for testing stuff. But they, you know, some people say, well, maybe that thing's leaking, and they're picking up a signal from themselves. They said the amount of methane that they're detecting. They said the whole area around the whole rover would have to be covered with methane to get this amount of signal that they're getting, that amount of methane. So it's an open question, some scientists think that it just has to do with the season. You know, is it, you know, getting too hot or too cool, or, you know, why are things changing? Or why is it one time it's high, one time it's low? So they're going to be looking into it. NASA, last time I read, hasn't released the information yet. Let me drop it. Apparently, the New York Times received an email from somebody. Who knows what, you know, maybe somebody in NASA, maybe one of the scientists. I don't know who sent it, but they received the information, and apparently they've been verifying it with other people. So, yeah, I've seen it on ABC, a couple of actual websites, but New York Times is pretty reliable. And I'm assuming, you know, sometimes they come up with these things. NASA will discover, well, we have this and that, and they'll make a deal out of it. You know, we'll have a news conference next Tuesday or something, and we're going to talk about it. You know, so I wouldn't be surprised if something like that came out. As of right now, it's unless you saw something, NASA hasn't officially said anything about that. And I think the last time I read something about that was yesterday afternoon. Back to you, Frank. WB2BXO WS2X.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same report because I saw that yesterday also. The other interesting thing on CBS Sunday Morning, Elon Musk's number two person, I didn't catch her name, said apparently that they want to start landing equipment on Mars in 2022, and they apparently believe they can land a crew on Mars in 2024. I mean, that sounds incredibly optimistic, doesn't it, considering that NASA is saying they can't do it till sometime in the 2030s?
Yeah, Frank, well, that's Shotwell. Her last name is Shotwell. She's been with them since the beginning, roughly the beginning, I think, you know, since he started the business. You might know his story. He went from the computer world, PayPal, and then sold that out. He had a bunch of money, and then that's how he started SpaceX. And no, I haven't seen that report. You got to remember, SpaceX is always very optimistic. But one thing about them is a lot of the things they talk about tend to come true. Falcon Heavy, I was talking about. Originally, it was supposed to launch in 2013, but, you know, stuff gets in the way. So they didn't launch until 2018, February 6th. That was the first time they got the Falcon Heavy off the ground. 5 years off, but it did work out. Different in a launch complex, different state. Originally, the Falcon Heavy was supposed to launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and eventually they wound up launching from a launch complex 39A in California. So I'll have to look for the reports. I haven't seen that one yet. Yeah, it sounds optimistic, of course. He is building a spacecraft, actually two of them, one in Texas and one in Cape Canaveral, one in Florida. They're actually identical right now, and he's calling them the Starship. And I think I predicted last week or the week before, I said, you know, yeah, NASA's having a lot of trouble with, well, with the government, the administration, and the on again, off again type of thing with going to the moon, or they don't know where they want to go next. You know, that's the problem with any administration. You know, let's do something, and let's make sure it's within 4 years of my administration, or within 8 years, you know. And it's hard for politicians to think beyond that. But private companies aren't like that. Elon Musk is going to be the leader of SpaceX forever. He's their key man. In fact, I believe they take out something called key man insurance on him, you know, in case something happens to him. You know, he's the guy that really drives this whole company. So he's building Starship, and he plans on eventually sending it to the moon with some fella from Japan, and he's already put up a bunch of money to be the first one to do this. And all he wants to do is orbit the moon and come back, and he's willing to bring along a half a dozen other people. He wants to bring along poets and artists and who knows who, but you know, this is what's going on with SpaceX. And yeah, his ultimate goal is to go to Mars. And to, you know, do I think they're going to make it in time, 2024? No, I don't think so. But, you know, I'm going to say within our lifetime, or within Elon Musk's lifetime, let me put it that way, he's going to definitely, he's pushing for this. That's his ultimate goal. He's all about Mars. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, very good. It's kind of fascinating. Yeah, it was interesting to see her on TV this morning. As a CBS Sunday Morning, I think last week, talked about apparently NASA's plan, I suppose, to fund the moon mission by inviting space tourists to go to the ISS for, I guess, a couple of million bucks a ride. I guess is a way to generate the revenue to support the moon program, which Congress, I guess, doesn't want to fund. what did you think of that one? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the theory is good, but you need about 20 more international space stations and hundreds of more launches, and we're going to get all these people. NASA would only they're only going to get $30,000 a day per day for somebody to go up there. So they go up there for, you know, for 10 days, for instance, and NASA will get $300,000. That's nothing. That's peanuts in the space world. $300,000 isn't going to do you much. On top of that, the guy that launches himself to the International Space Station has to pay for a launch vehicle. Well, NASA's not going to do that. NASA's not going to do that for $30,000. You have to pay Elon Musk for a seat, and that's going to be like, I don't know, they said like $50 million or some ridiculous amount of money to get onto a Dragon crew vehicle. So you're paying $50 million plus, you know, who knows how much for whatever money you got to pay NASA to stay on the space station. I don't see it ever happening. It's just a story that they're coming up with to try to make it seem like, oh, we have a way out. We're gonna get money now to do this. No way. They need, right now NASA gets like $20 billion per year. Just the thought is, you know, if they want to go ahead with this Artemis, they call it the Artemis moon program instead of Apollo, it's called Artemis. They're going to need $1.6 billion. That's just for starters. they did some estimates. I think they said somewhere around $20 or $30 billion they would need to complete this, to try to get, you know, enough funding to land people back on the moon. Let me drop it. By the way, her name is Gwen Stobwell. She's like, they give her the title as president. Where Elon Musk is CEO. So, any other comments or anything further on this topic? This is WS2N. Okay, talking about the moon, now that you have the 10th anniversary of the LRO, that's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's been going around the moon now for 10 years. Doing good work. All kinds of countless pictures. They've been able to photograph the rovers, the three rovers that are still sitting on the moon, all the landing vehicles except one. I can't seem to find that one, I think. All the half a dozen, and there's been six lunar landing, manned lunar landing missions that were accomplished from Apollo 11 through Apollo 17, of course, excluding Apollo 13. Of course, that didn't make it. So, photographs, and then also has lasers on the board. When lasers are operating, it sends out like 28 pulses a second or something of lasers to the lunar surface. So they have a topography map of the lunar surface. They say that can't be beat. So if NASA does manage to pull a rabbit out of the hat and get enough money to develop the Artemis program and start landing people on the moon, part of that whole program, by the way, is to set up a gateway space station around the moon, and people are going to use that as a way station to go down to the moon and back up. They're going to need enough money to pay for the Blue Moon project. That's a lander that Blue Origin is developing. They'd have to pay enough money to Lockheed for developing their lander that they're trying to develop. Where are they going to get all this money from? So, if they manage to pull a rabbit out of the hat, they're going to have the great pictures and topography from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Let me drop it. And that's it. A lot of the private, smaller companies, you know, they're getting ready to launch rockets into space. You have companies like Firefly, Lab is already launching rockets. I think they've launched about 6 rockets from New Zealand into orbit. You have another one that probably will launch a rocket to orbit probably by the end of the year. That's Virgin Orbit. Virgin Orbit has the 747, and they're going to have launch a one, they call it, their own rocket. They're going to be able to drop it from the wing of the airplane and send out into space, and not with people, but cargo. And as Firefly, I mentioned, they're going to be, they've taken over Delta 2 launch pad in Vandenberg, California. So you're going to have a lot of private companies. Vector is another one. They've launched suborbital flights and launch orbital flights. So there's going to be a lot to cover here when time goes on. Of course, manned missions are the most important ones. We'll see how that works. The International Space Station with McKay. She's still on board. She's coming down on the 24th. Oh, okay, I think that's tomorrow, right? The 25th. They're supposed to be coming down. I have to check. I think it's this week. So Anne McKay, she's one of the American astronauts. She'll be coming down with David St. Jacques. He's from Canada. He'll be coming down with the Russian commander on the Soyuz vehicle. They'll be landing in Kazakhstan within a day or two, I think. So that'll leave 3 people on board. you have the other Russian commander, you have Christina Koch, she's the one that's going to be up there for like a year, and you have the other fellow, Hague, his name is, he was the one that, he got a second chance to go up, they had to abort last year, going up to the space station. So, that's it. Don't want to take any more time. We have 4 minutes left. See if anybody has any comments or questions. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Any questions? See if this is out there. T2RIW, WS2N. Have any comments or questions? That was closed down. We'll be back next week. If not, we'll go over to Roy to see how he's doing.
You're going to close down early tonight. Okay, George. I mean, Paul, good stuff. So I guess we know what you're going to be watching next, that next launch, and what's your prediction as to the probability of it going smoothly?
I think it's going to do good. I mean, they get better with every launch, you know. I mean, you have this Falcon Heavy going up tomorrow at 11:30 at night. If I miss that because for any reason, they do show repeats on the webcast, the SpaceX webcast. And, you know, I mean, you have everything from that to suborbital launches. You had Rock On, they launch rockets from, it's college groups, you know, they launch rockets from Wallops Island in Virginia. And they had a launch just Thursday. And it was successful. They sent up 28 experiments, suborbital, but it's pretty cool. And one of the guys that we deal with, K1MJM Mike, we call him Mike number two from Connecticut, is usually heavily involved with Rock On. And I don't know if he's involved with this one or not, but he has been in the past. We got a lot of information on Mike. So everything from suborbital flights to these massive orbital flights, I'll try to be covering in the future. Hopefully, we know Rock On got off okay, but hopefully the Falcon Heavy makes it. Back to you, there.
Very kind, Paul. Thank you. Okay. This was TechNet number, what? I believe it's approximately 1,750. And Roy, I think Roy just gave us his science talk number 79. Over to you, Roy, for any final comments. And maybe you want to repeat your addresses and email, your URL by which people can get all your material. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. And as always, if you have any topics that you would like me to try and explore, questions you'd like me to ask, answer, if there's anything that you don't feel is correct and you want to correct me, feel free. I take correction. If you have any mailbag questions for Dick, that's how this all began, me being the mailbag guy, like the late John, KC2WGB. If you have any of these things, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all the links to all the articles, all the stuff that I can imagine putting up, you can find on the web browser by just typing in roy.ac2gs.com. In addition, I took the opportunity to look up how magnetic film works, and it pretty much as I kind of thought it might. There are microscopic magnetic granules that are suspended in an oil, and those are sandwiched between two pieces of plastic. Very interesting thing to play with. I would suggest that if you have nothing better to do someday, you buy yourself a little piece of it and take it around the little gadgets and toys that you use to see how many things are magnetized. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie, 2 Golf Sierra, and as always, I thank Dick for giving me the opportunity to do this, to Paul for being there with me, And to all you guys and girls that listened and participated, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. So this is AC2GS, and I am clear.
Hi, Roy. I got one quick question for you. That oil that's between those two sheets of plastic, if you hold that magnetic detector vertically, what stops the oil from running down to the bottom and separating the two pieces of plastic? There's something that keeps the two pieces of plastic at a fixed distance from each other. It's a very crafty design. I wonder how they did that.
I assume it's capillary action at work.
Okay. There may be some minor cells inside that we don't know about. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. K2RIW clear.
K2RIW-3HYY. You got a second here?
We're about to be cut off, but go ahead, Joe.
Are you available for double L tomorrow sometime around 5 p.m.?
Available for a blank. I missed that.
Landline.
Okay. If you like, I'll see if I can set 5 o'clock. Sorry.
Is that too close to your dinner hour? Would early be better or later be better?
You could call me right now.
I don't like ringing people's phones at 2:02 at night. You got people in the house, I don't want to wake them up.
You won't wake up anywhere in my house. Go ahead and call.
Okay.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Amateur Radio Repeater System.